Hello and welcome to The Shape of Work, a podcast series by SpringWorks. My name is Anoop and I am your host. Each week, we'll be talking to top people managers across the world on the future of work and how it's shaping our workplace. So sit back and get ready to find out more from these movers and shakers as we have a no-holds-barred, anything-goes conversation with them about their journey, their insights, their thoughts, and most importantly, their ideas and vision for the workplace of the future. Join in on the conversation, leave a comment, and don't forget to hit that subscribe button.
Hi, Tushar. Welcome to the Shape of Work podcast. How are you doing today?
Hey, Karthik. Thanks for having me over. I'm doing really well. It's 8 a.m. where I'm at, so just woke up, getting in some coffee.
Nice. Yeah, hope you got the coffee in. So, I think I like to start. I know you from the Manipal days, I think more than 10 years at this point. And you've kind of gone from doing your master's to starting your own company, raising a bunch of money, then selling it to a bigger startup. And now at literally one of the largest enterprises in the world, right? So how has this journey been from a founder to one of the senior employees and now, right, to I guess being a product manager at Walmart? How has that kind of journey been? Would you like to quickly talk about that?
Yeah. So I think for me, a lot of my desires as a person out of college was always I want to do stuff. I don't like when there's too much talk and no action. And that was kind of, so that's part of the reason why even out of undergrad, I joined a really small company, just got to learn what it, because they always make you do work. If you're in a small company, there is no escaping big talk. But after my master's at CMU, obviously there are a bunch of visa restrictions as an immigrant. So you kind of have to join a company which will sponsor your visa. So that really led me to a company called Pivotal, where their culture was primarily around agile and how do you do extreme programming, pair programming. And that was a good insight into something that I was learning at school, actually. So I was studying on these different software engineering practices, processes. And at Pivotal, they literally took it to an extreme where you really learn about each and every process. And it's good, right? It's a good life lesson where if you take a process and apply it to the extreme, what outcomes do you get? But that itch of doing something that in a small team where there is a lot of talk and there's a lot of talk, but very little action, was always there. So a friend of mine reached out to me, and this was funny enough. I was trying to sell him Pivotal software. He was working at an enterprise, always trying to sell whatever my company is doing. Even though I was not in sales. And he told me, hey, I have this idea. Do you know any technical co-founder, technical people who can help me to help him out? And I decided that, do you mind if I help you out? Right. That was my initial gut instinct, because he was talking about self-driving cars, maps. And I was like, that's pretty interesting. And being a business person, you always if a business person reaches out to you as a technical person, you're always a little skeptical that does this idea have any substance. So I kind of did a quick read on the technology and seeing if the technology really exists or the technology is very futuristic to create value in the market sooner. So post that, I think we started out, I found him through the CMU network. So my classmate's brother was the same person. And then I reached out to a third person, CMU being the School of Robotics and being worldwide renowned. I realized a lot of CMU people are actually in the self-driving car space. So I did reach out to one of my PhD students who was working in a lab at the time. And he had mentioned he had left his job, but we really reached out to him and said that, hey, would you be interested in starting something with us? And he came on board. So I think it was a lot of the founding team came from network I knew in my master's. And from that, I think the big...
you were at Pivotal when you started this. So you were
Yeah, so Yeah, I was full time. We didn't exactly started at that point. Okay. We were just still like figuring out like a bunch of things around visas and we had to make sure those like ducks line up before you like take the plunge.
Yeah.
So we did spend like some time. We applied to a bunch of accelerators, got into some. But I think for us, it was like, I guess you were a little arrogant at that point in time. You were like, we don't want to get into any accelerator because they take too much like equity.
Yeah.
And as a result of it, we did find some early angels who decided to put in money even before we like went full time. Nice. So that was helped in resolving a lot of the visa related concerns, because if you're even transferring a visa, you need to pay yourself a minimum wage. And that just... Correct. Yeah, so that really like helped doing a bunch of those transitions. And so we did spend like about a year and a half like trying to sell this idea and to a variety of customers. And we quickly realized that mapping for self-driving is like big money problem. So most companies are investing upwards of like I think Uber was investing $500 million internally. Wow. And if companies commit that sums of money internally, because the map data is really valuable, right? I think the map data is really valuable. So the presentation layer, the processing layer are not as critical. It was a lot of like, it was more of a data driven business. Like you buy and sell actual data, which is collected through like hardware, right? So it felt more like an operations business. And not so much a technology business, right? Even the biggest players, like there were incumbents, like I think from the 1800s in this space in America, like they would start, they started building like maps for like for fire engines and stuff, like really, really back in the day. So I think it was a very, very big incumbent driven space. Yeah. So after a while, we got to a point where we could either continue, like we could pivot the business to something, or we could sell, and we took the latter option because I think after a while, like if you've not, we had these like early stage conversations as founders that these are the trigger points. Like this is our personal
like
runway.
No go.
Like a personal runway conversation, and we realized okay, our personal runway is running out, and we still had like student loans and a bunch of these other like responsibilities, right? So I think at that point we decided okay, it's a good time to sell.
Yeah.
So we reached out to a bunch of companies, and it so happened that retail tech and automated checkout was getting very popular. And one thing that struck me really well about retail was that the cost of AI mistakes are much lower because it's a financial loss on one item, which could be a few cents.
Yeah.
Versus in self-driving cars, like there is a loss of life if something gets messed up. So, so the ability to iterate, I think I like iterating a lot. I don't like this. There is this like golden, like at some future time, this thing will be ready.
Correct.
So retail tech was more accepting of iteration in computer vision. So that's kind of why.
So a lot more agile in that sense, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot more agile, not as agile as like digital products, but still more agile than self-driving cars.
Yeah, so, makes sense.
Yeah,
so that was the same technology useful there.
So a lot of the technology is very similar at a high level, right? Like there are a lot of it's a different scale problem, right? In like self-driving cars are like a lot of cameras with a moving vehicle. But like a retail store is a lot more cameras without a moving object. So the challenges are similar, but the scaling challenges are are different, right? So like the core technology remains the same, but the way you scale it is very different.
And how is the team integration then, you know, as in you would have to kind of talk to the entire team and say, you know, now we're moving to like a bigger company and we kind of, I guess, as in it's a pivot in most, as in, you know, because you're solving a different problem, maybe same, similar technology, but how is that kind of done? And were kind of people, you know, slightly apprehensive, okay, what will happen to my role? Do I have to report to someone new? What happens to my day-to-day work? Stuff like that.
Yeah, so that was... I think people are pretty open because they also saw that the like we were not able to sell our product, and And I think just to like give a little bit more color to like why we were not able to sell our product. In the automotive space, like they are a very big revenue business. So when you get into this really early stage, like when you sell to them, they for mm-hmm. them $1 million is like spare change. But yeah. a VC might look at $1 million as a lot of revenue.
Yeah.
So true. Lot of our competition was like, okay, we will like they would get $1 million contract of some shape or form, and VCs would be like, wow, that's a really big like revenue. And they would like get those valuations based on that. And we were like,
correct.
And since my co-founder was from the automotive background, we knew these like inner workings of, so that was our, like, I guess our bar for product market fit was very high, right? Which in retrospect could have been lowered and worked with more startups. But that was kind of where we, and our, so our, like our employees could see that mm-hmm. these things are really tough, right? The market is really tough and market is heating up.
Yeah.
And they were, and it made sense for mm-hmm. them to like, we had to be very transparent. I think going back to what you asked, I think the big thing was, how can we be transparent, like fully transparent with our team? It was an experiment, right? Like as managed, like first time managers, we were like, okay, let's see how this team reacts.
Yeah.
And people are actually very like receptive to being more transparent than mm-hmm. we might assume. So they prefer to know the problems and exactly what our thesis is about, why this problem exists.
Mm-hmm.
And then they are willing to like get on your side and support whatever you're trying to do.
Got it. So you had to kind of buy, as in get in their trust and I guess understanding before you you did the decision. So you, I guess, explain the why behind, you know, the decision.
Yeah. And they may agree or they may not agree, but at the end of the day, they, you get their buy-in if you're, they're aware of why you're doing what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. So at least they're, you know, as in, you know, they have a choice and they have a choice after getting all the details. Makes sense. Makes sense. And from there, so you, you know, spent a bunch of time there and then you move to Lego and then completely different on the other side in an enterprise, right? How is that shift? And, you know, as in more from tech to also, I guess, you know, still tech, but not, you know, not kind of dev tech, right? So on the product side, how is that transition?
Yeah, so that transition was really, I think it's been that, I think that opportunity also came from my like CMU network, right? Not to like brag about the CMU network, but I think there is that bias and that network, like leverage does exist. Yeah. So the more people like spend some time building those networks, helping people out in your network. So it's not about what you get away, get out of the network. It's more about what you give to the network is what you can get out of the network. So But yeah, so the opportunity came up to me where initially I was a little apprehensive. I was like, okay, Walmart is a really like big company. And when the person who I was going to be reporting to like just posted a message, hey, I'm looking for computer vision people in retail. And I was like, okay, cool. This, like Walmart has the scale, right? Like one challenge I had in a startup was, like it's a chicken and egg. You get stuck into this chicken and egg problem with AI deployment. You're like, okay, we want to build this with AI, but we don't have enough data and we don't have enough deployments. So that, and to really like test out the AI in the wild, like I was like, what better place than Walmart? They have so many stores and physical retail is still like, is still live and kicking. So, it was like one of the better opportunities. And my team, I think, is like, my team's focus is to, is we are called like next gen strategic exploration. So it's a very exploratory role where we can work on things from crypto to AI to a bunch of different problems. But our target is like $1 billion plus impact, right? So that's the minimum bar for like a project in our team. So, so that was, I think, the attractive piece is like, if that is the level of impact, I was like, okay, I can, I'm willing to like be a part of it and like.
Got it. Makes sense. Makes sense. And then here, like, are you, so you, I guess you still have a team, you know, reporting to you and then you would be probably reporting to someone. It's like, how, you know, do you have to kind of assemble team on your own? How do you kind of, you know, decide, or is there a lot of, I guess, internal transfers because probably, you know, everyone wants to work on this team. Obviously, next gen, super cool. You kind of get to pick the problem you want to work on. So how do you kind of, you know, I guess, interview, or how do you kind of, you know, decide whom to hire here?
So I don't have a direct, like, I'm an IC now. So that's, I think, a transition from being a manager to an IC. Like, I just wanted a break from, like, people management. So it was a good, like, it was a welcome change. But for our team, the way we hire is we work extensively within, like, we find people within our network, right? Because most of the people on my team have been, like, co-founders or founders of different, like, in different parts of their life doing or worked in very small startups, right? So for everybody, it's like Walmart is a big company. So we are all learning the ways of working in Walmart together. Rather than it being that we are like, we are each have our own struggle with figuring out how does Walmart work. So that way our team is like, if I need something that, how does this X work in Walmart? I can just ask on my internal like team, like Slack channel, and they will be like, hey, just go and talk to this person or reach out to this person, or here's, I'll forward you an email. Like, it's very, that's, so my team within itself is very agile. So we operate like a team supporting Walmart, but we also know that we are not, like, we can get resources from Walmart if we work with those teams effectively.
Makes sense. So, and then coming back to your startup, so, you know, as a newer assembling, you know, team, obviously, you know, you look for, you know, you looked in your network, you look for skill, but apart from this, you know, what kind of other, I guess, you know, qualities were you looking for, you know, like, were you looking for like culture fit, like vision fit, you know, just kind of, and it's not easy to hire, especially someone in, you know, in the Bay Area for like a new company, you know, where like they're, you know, getting offers left and right from other, you know, technology companies. How do you kind of, you know, convince someone, and how do you kind of, I guess, filter, you know, for the right fit? Because you don't, you can't really afford to make a, you know, wrong hire, right, at that early stage.
Yeah, I think culture fit is a big part of the interview process. So definitely like referrals through the net, through our own networks. I think the first few hires definitely came through our own like friend or friend of a friend, a friend of a friend of a friend. And but there were some people who also, we were quite surprised that we did get some like quite experienced people applying for our company, even though they didn't end up accepting our offers. But I think it was a good, like a good part of that culture interview was how willing are you to get your hands dirty with problems versus be like, I'm a software engineer. I just write code and that's only my role and responsibility. And just understanding the person from a point of what are they incentivized, like, what are they trying to do in the long term in their career? Are they here to like make a quick buck, or are they, or are they just here for a resume bullet, or are they here for actually solving a tough problem with other people? So I think that was a big part of the interview process. It's hard, obviously hard to like judge that unless you have a clear, like one thing which we tried to do from the very first was have a clear, like, eliminate bias by having these like fixed set of questions that we would ask every candidate and try to get, like, that was, I think that was a very early decision we made.
Yeah.
And that I think helped us a lot in not getting carried away with like brand names and like, does, you don't have to be like a Stanford, MIT, CMU grad necessarily, like that doesn't matter to us. Like how you do at the interview and will you be able to create value for our company is, I think, the main focus there.
Makes sense. Yeah. So I think that's a very important point. So kind of having like a set of interview questions, I guess, pre-decided. So you're not really thinking on the fly and then you end up having like a bias just because this person is from your whatever, you know, CMU network or is from someone we know and stuff like that. So having, not having that even like, I don't know what type of bias you call this, but yeah, you know, having that kind of one person's bias and it's kind of fixed interview question. So you're evaluating everyone on the same same level without the network. Got it. Makes sense. So I think shifting gears, given that you, you know, actually worked in, you know, Pivotal as well, right? Like, And you know, now you see from an enterprise perspective on Walmart, like where, as you said, every possible resource is there, right? What should companies or, like, say, people managers do for, you know, productivity? And even more important in today's kind of, yes, remote hybrid world where companies are moving towards more async, right? So what should companies to really do to kind of improve this productivity, right? As in, what are some things which you have seen working? What are some things which you've seen, you know, not working? Don't have to get into tools, but like just from practices.
Yeah, I feel the best thing people can do to have people work is get out of the way. I think more often than not, at least in a lot of organizations, right? Yeah. People, like managers, tend to tie their ego into something, like into a specific technical problem.
Yeah.
And I think, and oftentimes they don't have the best information on the specific topic. So the IC never feels empowered because the manager is always in these, like, quote unquote important meetings where technical things get discussed without the IC being present. And I think that is a recipe for, like, cultural disaster, right? Like, if there's a certain problem, just to give you an example, right? If you're building a new front end tool and you have an engineering manager he's not fresh with, like, front end development and doesn't understand the code base.
Yeah.
They make these decisions that we will do this in 2 weeks, we will do this in 4 weeks.
Yeah.
It is a lost
estimate. Yeah.
It's a lost training opportunity because you can be present and you can have your front end engineer present, and then you can explain your thinking and context to that front end engineer person in your one-on-one or at a later date.
Sure.
Otherwise, you're getting secondhand information, right? And that also leads to lack of trust on the, like, engineer's point of view. Is like, why should I trust my manager, right? Like, my manager will tell X, and there is... So I think that's one part. And I think the second part is writing down decisions and writing down things. Like, even if you're not part of that meeting, just writing down the notes so that there is a shared understanding. Because when you don't write stuff down, that can be always... be misinterpreted, and you start losing trust very quickly because some people are scared to write stuff down because they were, like, they partially committed, right? They were not fully committed.
Yeah.
So pushing your managers to, like, write stuff down is a good way to test how much on board they are with whatever they are telling you, or are they hedging against something else, right? So that clarity of decision making is very important.
Got it. So to summarize, one is, I guess on estimations, kind of having your team or whoever is actually doing the work, you know, be part of that, either part of that first meeting or, you know, saying, okay, I can't really give an estimate without kind of talking to the team. And then the second is explaining the why behind the decision, right? And, you know, not just the why, but also to kind of the process to get to that, you know, decision. Maybe it's like sunsetting a feature, maybe it's, you know, pushing, delaying this to a later release, or maybe getting to an estimate. Got it.
Yeah.
Makes sense. So the next one, I would say, for, like, a new hire, I guess more in the context of, you know, Walmart, like when you have a new person come in, it takes a certain amount of time for that person to get familiar about, you know, the company, what are the company processes, the values and the culture. What do you think people, managers, or, you know, mostly HRs, what should they do, right? Obviously, that one person's manager maybe, you know, just walking through that company values talk, here is our PPT, here is our doc, and that's what mostly happens. What are some other ways to kind of, you know, get that person really into the team, right? Well, you know, in terms of, you know, different processes, different kind of, I guess, experiments you've tried, either in your startup where you want vision alignment, and then obviously in, you know, Walmart, you want to make sure, you know, they're going to fit in and they know where to go if they have a question and stuff like that.
Yeah, so I would say, I think it's part of it for, like, HRs is to minimize the number of systems, at least at a big companies, to minimize the number of systems they use for onboarding, right?
Yeah.
And have a clear system to these are the things, like, I think getting the baseline things out of the way and blocking time to do that, right? Like, be it payroll, like, mm-hmm. be it, I think a lot of times there is no recommendation that block their calendar for doing these things. So
yeah,
then the employee feels that I have to do this after hours or I have to do this.
Yeah.
That's not quote unquote work. So I think the first few weeks, I think that is really important so that people feel like they understand, okay, this is what exactly I signed up for. This is my team. I think the second thing is just getting to like know other people. I think there's a really good book on this topic called The First 90 Days, which talks about how to onboard yourself in a new company. And I think just like documenting more things as you're onboarding. I think creating this culture that our onboarding process is also an iteration, and your first task as a new member is to improve the onboarding process.
I see.
And start sharing onboarding context. Because I think once you get onboarded, it's very hard to force yourself to onboard yourself again. Because a lot of things also have changed in the they might have changed in the onboarding process, right?
Sure, sure.
So the way you get a laptop issued might have changed, right? So, so there's a lot of that, I think, which you just need to keep it fresh. So whenever you bring in a new employee, like, empowering them to change the onboarding process, and as a manager and HR telling them, this is not set in stone. Let us know how we can improve this part of the process. And like even explaining benefits, I think sometimes it is taken for granted that people understand what the benefits they are getting.
Correct.
And they send you to a web page and I'm like, just explain what is an HMO, what is a PPO. Like a lot of people don't know these things. And sometimes I think it's up to also the manager to like have a like kind of a set of articles, right? Like when somebody will tell me, what does this insurance mean? I'll Google search, I'll find the right, the appropriate language and the appropriate like link and just send it to them. I don't need to like do it myself, but they will get lost in the sea of Google search results. So it's better to like have a more curated way where as a manager, you know what these things are, but you don't know how to like write it down. So you just find the right resource and share them ahead of time. So this, I guess, accelerates a lot of the fear where what if I get injured? What if I think the getting those baseline emotional psychological safety as the first week of onboarding, I think is very, very first few weeks is very important. And then the second part is just building trust with other team members, just talking to them about random stuff, right? Like just doing one-on-ones with different team members and learning about what they do. Why did they join the company? So that way, as things get more and more complicated, you know that this person actually doesn't mean any harm. You don't make assumptions about their intent because you had this one-on-one at the very beginning and you know that they are in it for a good purpose, right? And you didn't sense anything like skepticism in the first few weeks. So
No, I think that's, you know, this point about as in actually the new employees who are being onboarded, if you ask them, okay, you know, if as in what, while you do this, you know, what are the questions you had and how would you have improved this process and, you know, improve it as you go, because you're right, as in if they have a question which is not kind of covered by onboarding, then the next person will also end up having the same question. So it's actually creating more work for the HR or, you know, the people ops team. And then, you know, I think this book, 90 days, because I strongly feel and this is kind of happening across the world now, right? Like onboarding has become so critical, especially in a remote hybrid world where, it's a lot of things can be solved when you're in, you know, in person, you're able to solve things faster. But in a remote hybrid world, things generally end up taking slightly more time because it's more async. And then people end up getting, you know, getting that frustration. Oh, I was not aware I had to do this. I didn't know about this, you know, work, because there's no kind of, I guess, the communication outside of work is generally less in a remote hybrid setting, you know, compared to an office. Yeah, so I think this onboarding is increasingly becoming more and more important, how it needs to be done. So yeah, that's a great point. So my last question here is, and you kind of touched about the benefits, right? How do new employees even know that this is one of our benefits, right? You know, something as small as in, not as small as, but something as common as, you know, PPO or HMO. But what are some of the benefits, or I guess more importantly, how should benefits be drafted? How should benefits, you know, be thought through? And from, you know, you can answer kind of from two different hats, right? One is you being the founder, and then now in like Walmart, where literally every single possible resource is there, right? So being like an employee, what are some benefits you actually see useful? What are some things you will want? And if, say, if you were to start a new company, say money is not a problem to a certain extent, what would be some things you would do and how would you kind of go about it?
Yeah, that's a really hard question, but I'll do my best to answer. So I think for me personally, there is, like, I think at least as of now, you choose a benefits provider, yeah. Right? I think there are a bunch of startups, at least in the US, Gusto and Rippling, who do a lot of this, like, take this load off you as a founder.
Sure.
Right? And then you just need to decide, this is my budget and this is what I can afford.
Yeah.
So I think that is one thing. I find, like, a good, I guess, the toughest persona to think about, like, benefits from a, I guess, a product perspective, like, just as a thinking like a product person is, like, for me, I think it's a single mom, right? Like, a single mom who's has to raise a child and has, like, so provide the most flexibility and benefits for this person. Because if that's your, like, North Star of, like, they should be happy, I'm pretty sure a lot of other people in that category or a person with disability, right? So if you can provide benefits and flexibility and an organizational culture that supports them, everybody else will feel supported just by default, right? Because so I think that's a really, I've found that a really good way to think about benefits and how to create a company culture that's very inclusive.
Makes sense. So you're probably solving for the hardest possible, you know, I guess, target audience there. And then, you know, assume that everyone else is not assume, fair, you know, way to say that everyone else would have already been solved for.
Yeah, just it's like keep that as your North Star, right? Yeah. Like when making trade-off decisions, like will this help this person or will this not? Because I think just being present at work and contributing to work effectively is sometimes like can become a challenge, like for new parents. I'm not a parent, but you probably can relate to that a lot more.
Makes sense. So, you know, like a quick, you know, question on this: how do you measure the ROI? As in, like a in the HR team, and then you know, like a manager, right? Because obviously, you as the HR always kind of asking for more benefits to your management, right? But how do you kind of like, okay, let's do this. But how are you able to say justify that 3 months, 6 months down the line? You know, is there like a metric rubric you have? Need not be objective, but maybe subjective as well.
Yeah, so I look at it, I guess, as twofold. Like one is, are people like using the benefits, right? Obviously, you can get that information from your provider. I think the second, so that's the quantitative part of the metric. And then I think on the qualitative side, I feel talking to your employees every like 3 to 6 months, because a lot of these things work on a yearly cycle, right? Yeah, so true. you kind of once you're signed up, up for a year at least.
Correct.
So you like that's, I guess, your iteration length. So use it as a way to like every 6 months, especially when people have like life events, right? Like they get married and they might have questions about like, how do I onboard my partner to my benefits or vice versa? And, or like if they have a kid, like what are, so I think those are those key like transitionary moments, right? Where they care more about benefits, right? So find those, I guess, hotspots during their career and during a one-on-ones, make sure that those benefits are like they fully understand those specific benefits, right? Because you don't, you might like early career, you might not worry so much about like retirement benefits, right? But sometimes just telling your employees that putting money aside in your 401k is important,
is
like
thing,
because this upper limit, like you might start earning like $1 million a year, but that whatever the IRS limit is going to stay the same. So you don't want to regret like at a future date that I didn't start doing these things early. So I think finding these hotspots of like, where are people in their life and understanding what are the right benefits they should be one, educated about, and two, like understand the I guess the diversity in your team, right? Like what makes the most sense for my team as of today? And mm-hmm. that obviously can change as your team grows and team evolves. So
got it. Makes sense. So yeah, so I guess this is so you either do through focus groups or I guess surveys and sometimes even one-on-one discussions is what you're trying to say, right? And because most of these kind of are, I guess some of them are life events, but some of them are just some things you'll probably avail once a year. Got it. I think that covers everything I have. I think last thing I would say is then you have a very active blog. Definitely keep reading about it. I think you posted something today as well. I did not have time to go through it. For our listeners, could you quickly mention your blog URL, and if people want to read more about you, where can, how can they follow you, maybe your LinkedIn, Twitter handle?
Yeah, so my blog is tushar.posthaven.com. And you can find me on Twitter at tushardardlani.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's mostly, I guess my blog is a big part of sharing what I've learned. And I think for me, it's been a big way to build connections with people with similar minded like ideas. Mm-hmm. So I just started writing. I took this writing course, The Art of Clear Writing. So people in India, Amit Verma has this really cool course, The Art of Clear Writing, which talks about how to be clear in your writing. And as a manager and a leader, I think communication is a very important skill. Written communication is sometimes more important than verbal communication because Jeff Bezos talks a lot about the writing culture at Amazon. So writing promotes a lot of clear thinking and makes you feel very clear. It took me a year to get started, to be very honest. So year of writing in my diary and having these notes, journaling every day. I got enough content to give me confidence that I can write for a larger audience than just myself.
Nice. Yeah, and that's great. Definitely we'll check out the course. Yeah, I started using Reflect recently with this, I think, Leo Bit guy. So I'm forcing myself. I paid for it. Now I'm going to force myself to journal every day. I do it, I think 3 out of 5 days. So I have to get better. But yeah, it's helping, to kind of do that mind map. And you're able to link, today's conversational, and add some notes, and I'm able to link to Shah to say CMU to Manipal and stuff like that. So let's see. Perfect. Yeah. Thank you so much.